for the house.
Oh, yes.
Bring back the original series?
So it's
call the House Committee on Judiciary to order, the Joint Committee.
And I also will call the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary to order. Thank you for everyone that's here. We do have a pretty full agenda. We do have members that are going to be coming and going because of other obligations, so please don't take it personal if you see someone standing and walking out. Hopefully they will be coming back, but it's not because of what you said or didn't say. It's because they have many other obligations. We are having informational meetings today, and we're going to be working from the top of the agenda forward or downward the agenda. So the first informational hearing, that meeting we're going to have was on the review of the University of Oregon's Inside Out Prison Exchange Program. And I will just do a caveat. I had the opportunity to meet with some of the students and have a presentation at the University of Oregon. This is something I asked that we bring forward because I think it's very important to show how various institutions within state government, in this particular case, a public university, is actually impacting individuals within the corrections facility. So with that, Chyna, do you have some?
No, Chair Prasansky, I don't have anything to add.
All right, so then I have Kathleen Dwyer, Professor Cohen, I should say, and also David Spencer. Why don't you, the three of you, please come forward and... For those who have not given testimony before, what we ask that you do is please give us your name before you give your testimony so it will be on the record. And just to let you know, we are live not only in this room, but there may be carried through the Capitol and also on our internet system.
All over the world.
Yes. On the World Wide Web, they say. Thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure. My name is Shaul Cohen. I'm a professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Oregon, and I'm also the chair of the University of Oregon's Prison Education Committee. As the chairman mentioned, I'm joined by David Spencer and Kathleen Dwyer, who will tell you in just a few moments their connection with the program. But I'd like to begin with an overview of what we're doing in terms of providing education in two area prisons from the University of Oregon. We're active in OSP and in OSCI. As part of a program that began at Temple University in Philadelphia called Inside Out. Inside Out brings campus-based students and instructors into prisons to hold courses there that are composed of an equal number of students from the campus and people who are incarcerated. These are regular college classes. All of the ones that we hold in the prisons at the University of Oregon are 400-level advanced classes. They meet on the regular term basis for 10 weeks. They have readings, they have assignments, they have dialogue and conversation. And those who complete the classes successfully earn 4 credits for their efforts in the class. We began doing this here in Oregon in 2007. We are at this time the largest Inside Out program in the country. Inside Out has grown from Temple University to be active in 40 states and 6 foreign countries. We're actually the most active program in the world. By now, we have taught 35 credit classes in the prisons. We have 10 faculty members who are trained to teach Inside Out classes. We're teaching typically now 6 classes a year in the prisons, 3 at OSP and 3 at OSCI, 1 each term. The classes are small by need and by design. So when we bring a class in, we're usually bringing 13 students from campus, an instructor and a teaching assistant. And we're pairing that up with 13 students and a teaching assistant from within the prison. In the past year, we've had approximately 140 University of Oregon students in the prisons to do college classes there. And they have been meeting with approximately 100 men who are incarcerated in these two prisons to study a range of topics. We have instructors and we offer courses from a range of disciplines, political science, geography, sociology, classes from the law school, from the College of Education, from English, and from humanities. And these courses are often evaluated by our students as being among the very best that are offered through the University of Oregon. They're not offered at the University of Oregon, but they are among our strongest courses. We're very proud of this effort at the university. We are eager to go into the prisons and engage there with people who are interested in study, with people who are interested in improving their minds and using them while they're incarcerated. The classes that we have there provide us with a fascinating blend of perspectives and experiences, something that we don't have on campus in that way. And that provides a really unique learning experience and opportunity for our campus-based students and for the men who are incarcerated. I'm going to let David and Kathleen tell you a little bit about their experience in the program, and then I'll come back and tell you a little bit more about what we're doing around the state and some of the other things that are connected with our program that are making an impact here in Oregon.
David. Hello. Thank you for having me. My name is David Spencer. I participated in the U of O's first Inside Out program as an inmate. And it was quite an experience. The opportunity to expand your field of vision when you're quite literally trapped inside of a cage is something that is important to take advantage of. And my takeaway from Inside Out were numerous. And the effect that it has on people who come out of prison is important because all of us have the same concern, safety. Everybody here is here because they want to make sure that the people leaving the prisons are safe to come back into the community. And what does it mean to have a person come out and be an effective citizen? Part of that is being able to get employed. And that is a mixture of things. Part of that is confidence, knowing that you can learn, knowing that you're capable of expanding your own thing, the things that you were ever capable of. Today, I'm an accounting major at the University of Oregon. I'm looking forward to graduating in June. But I'm kind of an anomaly. There are many more people who their story might not be, you know, they didn't go to the University of Oregon and graduate with an accounting degree. You know, they went out, but they had the confidence to go get a job. They had the confidence to, you know, have successful relationships. They found different ways to communicate with their partners, significant others. I'm lucky in that, you know, I've had an opportunity to interact with a number of different people as they've come out, and I've seen these programs that you might not think, okay, well, Inside Out is an educational program. How does it affect recidivism? It affects recidivism by affecting people. That number is not, it's a number, but it reflects the lives of individuals. And something like Inside Out that affords an opportunity for a person to expand themselves, that is the power of Inside Out. It's not whether you went in and learned Levinas. I don't know if anybody in here has ever read Emmanuel Levinas, but it's heavy reading, am I right? It's heavy reading. And it might not be something that's so applicable in your daily life. However, knowing that you can learn, knowing that you are capable of doing something that you may not have ever thought of, that is very applicable every single day when you wake up out of bed. And that's the importance of the Inside Out program. It's about giving people the confidence, not even the skills, the confidence, the belief in self, after you may have been sitting in a box for 7 years, 10 years. That is the important part. It provides a measure of sanity to think outside of your box, quite literally, again. And Inside Out was a wonderful experience for me. I often kind of tell the joke that nobody was going to stop me from getting educated. Okay, I was determined. But the people that it touched outside of myself, those are the people who, you know, it really mattered for. The people who would have ever thought they could have went to college. Never believed in themselves enough to do that. And so Inside Out is a wonderful program, and I'm excited to be here, and I'm looking forward to you having opportunity to learn about it.
So my name's Katie Dwyer, and I was part of the first class that the University of Oregon offered through the Inside Out program. I was a freshman at the University of Oregon, and when I saw the flyer for the class, I just thought, this is why I'm in college. This is what I want to do. I want to talk to people about issues. And that first class was in Russian literature. We read House of the Dead and Crime and Punishment. Mm-hmm. And I was floored by both the insights that the Inside students offered and also by how much it pushed me to examine my experiences, my position in relation to my education, and to a broader world. And so I took that first class, and at that time, there wasn't any structure here in Oregon for any further involvement, but I was incredibly inspired by what I had learned. And so I went to the assistant national director of the program, and we designed an internship that I participated in then, doing research, doing program development. I helped start the first alumni program for University of Oregon students who had completed the class to do a book club at the juvenile facility in Eugene at Cerbu. And then I became the first undergraduate who was trained as an instructor in the program. I took a second class to examine the pedagogy more closely. I wrote my undergraduate thesis on the Inside Out program and received a President's Award for my thesis, and was invited to be the commencement speaker for the Honors College, and was a Phi Beta Kappa Oregon 6 for 2010. And at the commencement address, there were approximately 30 other students who had participated in the Inside Out program, and I evoked our fellow Inside students who had had this experience with us, who weren't present at graduation but had been a part of our journeys and who had challenged us to think about education, to think about discourse, to think about structures in society in a new way. And so I graduated. I decided to stay in Oregon and do a master's in conflict resolution. I was a graduate teaching fellow, and I helped nurture new professors who were new to the program to adapt their pedagogy to the program. I helped Shaul Cohen teach his first class. And then I graduated. I received a Mitchell Scholarship, which is similar to a Rhodes, and I went and studied international human rights law in Ireland, and have since returned and have re-engaged in this program, including as a mentor to existing students who are still engaged in volunteering, in mentoring, both on a re-entry basis with at-risk youth and with incarcerated youth. And I have also, this term, for the first time, been the instructor of record for an Inside Out class. I'm teaching a class entitled Liberating Education, and we are engaging with questions of pedagogy, of the school-to-prison pipeline, and of all of these broader issues of how our identities intersect with education and the ways that we can impact that in a positive way. And what I am seeing from both my Inside students is a willingness and an ability to look at the ways that those have impacted them. And for my Outside students, some of whom are headed for Teach for America, for the Peace Corps, for careers in teaching, among a broad range of other things, this has been a chance to really dive into a way that me, as a middle-class white kid, when I grew up in the suburbs of Colorado, I'd never had a chance to do this before. So back to Shaul to hear more of the structural questions.
I hope it's apparent that this program has an enormous impact on the students. It has an enormous impact on the universities as well. So we've invested heavily in this program at the University of Oregon, but we're not the only ones. There are Inside Out instructors at Oregon State, at PSU, at Clackamas, at Chemeketa, and at Lewis and Clark. And there are Inside Out courses being offered at OSP, at OSCI, at Coffee Creek, and at Columbia River. We hope that the program can continue to expand because we believe that it's valuable to the people who are participating. But I think that there are some additional influences of the program that I'd like to share with you. As David mentioned, people who come into these classes learn a lot about themselves, and one of the things that they learn is that they can have a place back in civil society, that they can be respected, that they have something to offer, that they can get along with people who are not part of the world that put them on a path to incarceration. We feel that those people, and we hear from them, are sharing these experiences with their families, and that the ripple effect is going on back to their communities. One of my students told me just this past December, when our course concluded, that he had spoken with his daughter for the first time in 6 years. She was graduating from high school, and they hadn't spoken, and he told her what he was doing in an Inside Out class, and she said, "Daddy, you're a college student." And he told us in the class that he had never thought that he would be able to describe himself that way, but hearing her say that, he recognized that that was both true in the moment and could be true of his future. And the next day, he signed up for the Chemeketa Community College, College Inside Associate's Degree Program, something that he hadn't contemplated prior to this experience. So we're eager to make that kind of a contribution and have that kind of an impact. David talked about recidivism, and I'm sure you know that there's a very powerful correlation between education in prisons and lower rates of recidivism. Oregon is already good in that regard, but we're eager to help make it better. I think that we have a role as a university in contributing to and expanding the Oregon accountability model, which talks about adult basic education, GED, and vocational training. We think that there's place in there for post-secondary education as well. As you know, there are some prisons in Oregon that are places where people can earn an associate's degree. Just this year, the University of Oregon has begun enrolling, admitting people who have their associate's degree for bachelor's degrees at the University of Oregon, which they can earn while they're incarcerated through the classes that we're bringing into the prison. So we began that this year. We hope to have a graduation at OSCI, I would guess, in about 24 months for the first of those students. And we hope that those numbers will continue to grow. This is something that is part of a broad and growing national conversation that, of course, you're aware of about incarceration. We feel that our contribution is central to the dialogue about how to provide opportunities so that prison is a more productive way station on the way to a healthy life post-release. 95% of the people who we encounter in the prison are coming back out to be part of the communities again. We think of them while they're in our classes as students, and I think it's healthy for them to be thought of that way. It tells them that prisoner is not their only identity and prison is not their only occupation. As I say, we've been investing in this program quite heavily. The University of Oregon administration has been marvelous. The faculty are doing this. Many of their efforts are essentially volunteer and beyond the scope of their remit and their salary. But we feel that the reward is in the work and that the benefits are for the community as a whole. I'm grateful to the chairs for the invitation and to all of you for your time, and we're happy to answer any questions that you might have.
And are there any questions? Thank you all very, very much for taking time out of your day to present to us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So our next informational hearing is going to be on the development and use of legality of assessment tools. I believe we're going to have this presentation in two parts. The first is going to be Ryan Labricki, I hope. Okay. Close enough. Sorry, Ryan. You can correct me. And then we'll have another panel after Ryan finishes his presentation.
Thank you. It's actually pronounced Labreck. So
Labreck.
You're very close. It looks a lot worse than it is.
I saw the end of it thinking barbecue, you know.
Yeah,
how could I work that into it?
Not bad.
All right, get started?
Yes.
All right, well, thank you. My name is Ryan Labreck. I'm a professor at assistant professor at Portland State University. I'm a former probation officer. I spent nearly 10 years working in the field, conducted probably more than 1,000 offender assessments in my time, and then I went to the University of Cincinnati where I studied, and I had the opportunity to work on developing and validating various risk assessments. So I'm very pleased to be here today talking to you about domestic violence risk assessments in terms of the Bill 789. And thinking about what are some considerations for the selection and the use of the particular risk assessments. First of all, effective policies and practice really hover around this idea of risk assessment. It's been defined in our field as being the cornerstone of effective evidence-based practices. And if you look specifically in the field of corrections, we know from decades of research that risk assessments help make us, help officials make better decisions related to arrest, bail, sentencing, as well as for treatment. And looking just at the treatment context, we know that if we provide intensive services that match the criminogenic needs of offenders that are high risk, we can reduce recidivism by up to 26%. And that's a very, very large number. So it makes sense to then consider the use of risk assessment with domestic violence offenders. Specifically, this bill would require law enforcement officers to perform a lethality assessment, is how it's written, after making a mandatory arrest for domestic assault. So I would like to sort of talk about the use of different types of domestic violence assessments that are available. They're good in that they can help criminal justice agencies or agents identify who is more likely to be a recidivist, who's more likely to be a recurrent offender. However, it gets complicated when you look in this literature because there's a whole bunch of DV risk assessments, and there's also these practical considerations that I think need to be taken into consideration in having law enforcement officers at the front line conduct these assessments. And the focus is really to just describe these assessments, their strengths and weaknesses, raise some concerns that I think you should consider. I'm not advocating by any means for any one approach, but I just think that having this information will help you make a better decision. There are ideally four categories of risk assessments that we could apply to DV situations. The first falls under the partner or the victim ratings. And this can be something as simple as an officer asking the victim if they think that the offender is going to do this again. And these have actually shown, just that one question has shown some ability to know who is going to recidivate, probably because the victim knows the offender better than anybody. But there's also assessments that take into more questions than that, and the victim rates them. We have another set, which is the structured professional judgment, and these use some empirical items in their construction. However, the overall risk prediction is left up to the evaluator. So even though there's some standard items that they score, the person evaluating them, it's up to their feelings and interpretation to make that overall risk. The other one is the actuarial risk assessments, and these are simply statistical formulas that combine certain risk factors or characteristics into one model that will be able to maximize predictive accuracy. It's a purely mechanical process, so that if there are 10 items on an assessment and an offender has 9 of those, he's at greater risk than if he were to have 5. And there's no discretion, there's no leeway there. The last sort of type of assessment that we could consider using is sort of general risk assessments, or those are risk assessments that were created to predict things like general recidivism or violence in general. There are some studies that have looked at using these assessments to predict domestic violence-related outcomes. So I thought it would make sense to know that there's lots of different assessments that fall within these categories, but there are talks about certain assessments and sort of advocating for some use. I thought I would talk about the more popular ones. In terms of the victim ratings, the danger assessment is one that has been discussed. This is a lethality scale, which matches the terminology of the bill. It was designed in the context of the hospital, an emergency room, to be used by nurses in the 80s, and it measured the probability of that person being killed by their domestic partner. Essentially, it's been revised, and the most recent version includes 20 simple yes or no items, where the victim would score those. Having a higher score on that assessment would equate to having a higher risk. The next model is the structured professional judgment model, and you may have heard of the spousal assault risk assessment, or the SARA. Designed to assess the recurrence of spousal assault. This was constructed in Canada on a sample of mostly probationers as well as some inmates that were on for domestic violence. And here, the assessor rates 20 items. They fall under several domains, but including criminal history, psychological functioning, social adjustment. And these are based on an interview or information from the offender, from the victim, as well as a review of records. And so the thing here that separates this from the actuarial assessments is that the final determination of risk is left up to the trained professional to make that. Now, the one that I think has the most that's talked about here is the ODARA, which is the Ontario Domestic Assault Risk Assessment. This was designed as well in Canada to predict violence against a female domestic partner. Now, it was developed in a police sample for men that were known to have an assault against a female partner. And the assessor rates 13 items. There's 13 items to score, and this includes, the domains of substance abuse, their history of violence, children, barriers to sport, and this is done through a review of records. So those can be police or law enforcement records, as well as an interview with the victim. Now, some have raised this question, do we need to use a specific domestic violence tool? You know, could we use something like the level of service inventory or the psychopathy checklist or these other assessments, which were designed to predict general recidivism or violent recidivism? The reason why this is theoretically a question is that the major risk factors of domestic violence are similar to those of general recidivism. So things like having an antisocial attitude or having antisocial cognitions, these are the same predictors. Therefore, these assessments may be able to predict as well. So I bring up the results from a meta-analysis, which is a study of studies that looked at all of the available empirical studies that used sort of a risk assessment to predict domestic violence assault. And so you can see I have them listed in the way that I've just described. You have here, if you're not familiar, K equals the number of independent effect sizes. So there's five studies that fell into the partner victim ratings. The N is the number of offenders within each group. And then the mean effect size is represented by Cohen's D, which is a standardized difference of the two means. To be able to interpret that, it just tells us how large or small that difference is, how big of an effect they have. So Cohen's guidelines, 0.2, 0.5, and 0.8 are roughly equivalent to small, medium, and large differences. So what you can see here is that the partner, the structured professional judgment, and actuarial risk scales seem to do pretty similar with one another, right around 0.4. The general risk assessments do a little bit better at 0.54 in predicting domestic violence assaults. But what we're talking about today is not purely about an ability to have the best predictive accuracy. It's also about feasibility and how will these assessments be used by law enforcement officers when they're arresting offenders. So some things that I think we should consider in terms of selecting a particular risk assessment, I'll start just with the victim ratings. Such as the danger assessment, it relies upon the judgment of the victim. And these items could be rated differently by different victims under different circumstances. Sometimes the victim is not available, or she may not be willing to participate. She may refuse. So while there is some evidence that the victim, they have an ability to predict reassault, the question I might raise is, do we want law enforcement officers at the time of arrest collecting that information from the victim? In particular, the danger assessment, for example, has some items about the victim's prior suicidality, asking whether they have engaged or attempted suicide in the past. And maybe there's a possibility that this information could somehow be used for the advantage of the perpetrator. So if they acknowledge that they had prior a suicide attempt, does that give the an attorney, a defense attorney, an ability to say, well, there's some mental health concerns of the victim? Or what if she rates her safety or her own assessment of danger as being relatively low? Could that be used then against to support the perpetrator? So just some things to consider. When we look at the structured professional judgment or the SARA type models, what we see is that these models or these assessments are generally recommended to be conducted by mental health professionals. So it's not mandatory, but there's an extensive amount of training that goes on here. And we know it's not only from this type of assessment, but the quality of the assessment depends on the skills and the training of the person that is evaluating conducting the assessment. So this would require a lot of training as well as oversight to make sure that officers were not only trained in it but using them appropriately. It also requires interviews with the offender, with the victim, as well as collateral information. So things that may not be available to an officer. He's certainly not going to have any psychological assessment information available to him in a squad car, for example. And then we also have to consider how much time can a law enforcement officer spend conducting an assessment. The SARA takes between 60 and 90 minutes, which probably put it outside the window of being too long. Now, the ODARA is an interesting one because it's one that's been talked about. There are some challenges, however, in sort of taking an assessment that's developed in another area, another population, and putting that to a local sample. Doesn't mean that it can't happen, but there are issues with, does this assessment generalize to other populations? Does it generalize to the population that we would seek to be using it for? There's also some issues with acquiring sort of similar data. For example, the ODARA items are not necessarily always available from the state police records. My colleague Chris Henning, who's our chair of the department, is more familiar with this, but he tells me that when they're looking up the past criminal record of offenders through the state police system, that you can't always tell the relationship between the offender and the victim. And so two of the first items on the ODARA, you need to know whether or not the assault was on a family member. And if we weren't able to get that information, how would we effectively do the ODARA assessment? The other part is that some of the items on ODARA also require an interview with the victim. So if the victim is not willing to participate or give information, then we wouldn't be able to complete that assessment. The final one, the general risk assessment, if we were to use something like the LSIR, this does have the highest predictive validity. This also has, of all of them, it's important because it does provide us with information on criminogenic needs or what things we could target for intervention with treatment. Again, this raises questions about time and feasibility. It can take between 30 and 45 minutes to assess appropriately. There are some screener versions of tools like the LSI, which can take less time, between 10 and 15 minutes. However, we don't know necessarily that those tools are as predictive as LSIR in predicting domestic violence. So we don't know at this time. These tools simply may just be more appropriate for probation or for prisons or institutional settings versus the officer at the time of making arrest. So there are many different options that are available in selecting a domestic violence risk assessment. Each of them comes with strengths. Each of them comes with weaknesses. There is another option, which I think you can consider, which is developing a local actuarial risk scale here in Oregon. This may help and be advantageous to be able to address some of those limitations from some of the other assessments. One of the things that we could do then was simply define a population that we're trying to make predictions about, and that could be suspects involved in DV incidents. We would specify then some sort of outcome. We'd have to figure out whether that would be new domestic violence offenses, would be any violence, or it was a lethal outcome. We'd find a sample of cases, so we may go 2010, 2013, look at all those cases around the state. Collect the information from them, things including the offender information, arrest records, things that would be available to officers at the time of making the arrest. And then we would collect the outcome data, and through taking all of those items and then correlating them at the individual level to see which items are predictive, we would combine them into a tool and be able to create something that was actuarial in nature and that could be used by officers at the stage of arrest. What we would hope to find then is to have something like this. This is from another assessment that was created, and the red line here indicates the percentage of the cases that fall into each of these groups. So you can see that the majority of the offenders are falling within the middle range, and as you start to get out to the high range, there's fewer and fewer offenders. These are our truly high-risk offenders. The blue bars represent the percentage of those that recidivated. So you have over here who scored a 0.81 or higher are going to be up around the points, would be 70%. Now, what we would do using this information then was to create cutoff scores based on them to be able to categorize offenders into low, medium, and high risk, where you would then do something differently with those high-risk offenders, perhaps, and then implement this and conduct research. So just another option that we have. So, in conclusion, risk assessments have a considerable influence on the responses of police, courts, probation, as well as treatment, and they can be used to increase public safety. However, the use of DV assessments in Oregon is important. It's worthwhile. There are some things, though, that we have to consider with the bill. Some of these things that I would raise are, how are law enforcement officers going to conduct this assessment? Are they going to do it, in their squad car as they're going to the jail? Are they going to have access to all the necessary information? If we're going to require that they have psychological information on the offender, how are they going to get that? There's going to be training that's going to have to occur, so we need to make sure that they get the appropriate training and that there's oversight. So you can't just train them and then leave it. There's got to be people that are monitoring to make sure the assessments are used correctly. And then, how much time can they spend on the assessment? It's very important, but we also have to remember they have other things to do. So, if we want them to only spend 10 minutes, we're not going to be able to do some of the other assessments. We have to consider if we develop or construct something, what if the victim doesn't want to participate? We would then not be able to get that information, so we have to sort of consider that. We have to consider what outcome are we trying to predict. If we're trying to predict simply lethality, we have something that's more of a rare outcome. So our base rate is going to be relatively low. It's going to be something that is a little bit harder to predict and that we're going to potentially over-classify of some offenders so that we'd say that they fall into the high-risk group, but then they don't actually end up recidivating to that degree. So we also could use violence or domestic violence. We got to consider what that would be. And finally, what information what is this information going to be used for? There is sort of this issue if they're conducting this risk assessment at the time of arrest, which is written in the bill, there's already probable cause that they engaged into some domestic violence, right? So that's why they're being arrested. Perhaps you could say that we're conducting this assessment to figure out which of the two parties is the aggressor. In which case that could be true. But in most situations, that's going to be relatively known to the officer in terms of when they're making their arrest. The other last issue, I guess, here is just, are there any unintended effects of having law enforcement officers versus mental health professionals or somebody with probation or et cetera doing these assessments? With that, I thank you for your time, and if you have any questions, I'm very happy to answer them.
Okay, Ryan, I also understand you may be able to stand by just if there's questions that come up after the second panel.
Absolutely.
So are there questions now? Representative Greenwood.
Thank you, sir. There's the balance between the false negative and the false positive. You talked about the false positive as an issue. How do we put substantive value on how much you balance that to false negative or false positive?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And that's really, you have to balance. It's a give and take. You obviously both are important. I mean, it depends. I mean, I think it depends on what assessment you're using and see what are the base rates and how many that might be. Because if you have too many of one way, you're either going to spend a lot more money incarcerating or prosecuting more people. But if not, you go the other way, too liberal, then you're going to end up letting these guys go and they could reoffend, and that's a bad thing. So it's splitting that hair, and that's a difficult choice.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Ryan, I have just a couple. I think your point's well taken. In our state, if you have someone that's being accused and charged with domestic violence, our law requires someone, the offender, to be going to jail. So they're actually being taken off the street. And I'm not sure where the ODERA would actually, what it would accomplish, because the person's already going to be taken into custody. It's not a decision to release them in the field. I don't know, and this is something maybe for counsel to be looking at, what happens in each of our counties in the state. I know in Lane County there's actually a release team that will make determinations as necessary for matrix in the sense of overcrowding or at some point, and they'll do what I would consider the risk assessment. I'm not sure which tool they're using. So I know that there's been some desire to have maybe this type of assessment done in the field, and I'm trying to, I guess, understand, and maybe you might have from your research information as to why it would be important or imperative to be doing it there as compared to a more, I hate to say clinical, but more a scenario situation where it isn't in the back of a squad car while they're driving down the road. Doesn't seem like you can actually maybe get the full assessment by having that type of conversation as compared to a dialogue directly face-to-face.
Sure, yeah, I think that there's some advantage to doing the, or getting some information straight away, and that is, one, the victim might be willing to talk during that pivotal time, and she may change her mind later on and not be able to provide that information. So whatever the officer can get on scene, so to speak, can be used for treatment purposes for that. So there's some bit there, but I agree that, you know, doing a full-on assessment makes a lot more sense, perhaps back at the jail or, you know, someplace where they have access then to their full file or their records, and being able to go back and see that, you know, their mental health information as well as their criminal history. You know, so there might be some advantage to getting some items, you know, at the scene to use that. But to do a full blown assessment, it seems to make a lot more sense down the road, since they're all, you know, they're being they're arrested at that point.
Right. So, well, I'm not sure, again, what the agencies are doing in the sense of law enforcement, but my understanding, there should be applying or giving to victims the notification card for victim services, and I'm assuming that most officers, that they're gathering enough information as to the basis for the probable cause. I understand from what you're saying that potentially there are some questions that could be asked that could be maybe more beneficial to have the victim speak immediately within that first 24-hour period.
Right.
For that information could potentially be used in the future.
Sure. Though they could, you know, get that information in the police report and the structure, and that could be then used by, you know, an assessor or a raider who's doing that somewhere else. So that makes it a little bit different than conducting the assessment themselves in a squad car or something. So.
Okay. Other questions, comments? Ryan, thank you very much.
Thank you, guys.
Let's see, our next panel presenting is Louise Richard, is it Lisa Swart, and Robert McCleary. Hopefully I didn't butcher those names too bad. Please correct me if I did.
Thank you. Do you want us to each introduce ourselves first? Or?
When you are speaking, if you'll do that, then that way it would be part of the record with yours.
Okay.
Thanks.
Hello, I'm Robert McCurley. I'm the domestic violence officer for the Medford Police Department, and I hope I can enlighten you on some of the stuff you've just been talking to the professor about. A little bit of background, briefly. About 14 years ago, my best friend was arrested for murdering his wife. He was an Oregon State Police Trooper. He was found not guilty at his trial, and it had a great impact on myself personally and my career. About 5 years ago, I asked our department if I could start a domestic violence program. I realized that law enforcement wasn't doing anything wrong. We could just improve on what we were doing. I got the okay to do that. So the first program I'm going to talk to you about is actually the Salem Police Department. I didn't know where to go. I found out Deputy Chief Belishaw from Salem PD had started a domestic violence program a number of years ago. So I came up and spoke with him. Generally speaking, the program they run there is there's several officers that are specially trained in domestic violence. And when there's a domestic violence call, at least one of those specially trained officers responds to the scene along with another officer. They don't necessarily handle the call, but they're there because of their specialized training. They also have their own advocacy program at the Salem Police Department, and an advocate goes to the scene of the domestic violence incident and tries to engage the survivor in services on scene of the incident. That wasn't really something we could accomplish at the Medford Police Department. So what we ended up doing is our officers respond to domestic violence scenes. I conduct the follow-up on all of our domestic violence cases, stalking cases, restraining order violations, protection order violations. We also partnered with the advocacy agency in Jackson County, and the city council agreed to dedicate funds to pay for an advocate to work with me full-time. It's Vanessa Espino. She was my advocate for 4.5 years. We decided we would have bilingual and bicultural. Approximately 19% of the population of Jackson County is Latino. And there are many times I would not have gotten even in the door without Vanessa being with me. When we conduct our follow-ups, we come out, I conduct any investigative needs, and we try and determine in a pretty brief amount of time the types of services that these survivors need. We have people in the community that will help us with drug and alcohol. We also have veteran services. I can get, for the offender or the victim, I can get a response team to come to their home or come to the jail and try and engage them in veteran services. We also engage them with our Jackson County Mental Health Department. And we sort of specialize it. There was a young lady who was HIV positive. One of my brothers has been HIV positive for 20 years, so I called him and said, what do I do? What do I tell her? And he told me what to say and how to approach it. Another young lady last week, her son at the age of 3 suffered a traumatic brain injury, and he has really no cognitive abilities. He has no motor skills. And this was a huge strain on the family. So I was able to find out some support groups and whatnot that can help them. So our program is sort of a 360-degree approach that if we show up and we get the offender out of the home, but we lose them to drug or alcohol addiction and mental illness, we really haven't done our job at that point. So we try and approach it that way. The common theme with Salem and with the way we do things in Medford is that you have police response that is beyond arresting the offender and getting them out of the home. The most important part of this is engaging them with advocacy services that will help them with the rest of the issue that's involved with domestic violence. I also help out with that. However, Vanessa does most of that part of it. I'm also the co-chair of Jackson County's Council Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. We received an arrest grant approximately 3 years ago, and under that grant, part of our responsibilities was to come up with a lethality assessment protocol for the county and try and get that implemented. About 4 years ago, we were in Boston for training with the Jeannie Geiger Crisis Center. Part of the training that we received was on the danger assessment with Dr. Jacqueline Campbell. Another assessment that we learned about was the Maryland Model Lethality Assessment Program. We came back and engaged all of the law enforcement heads in Jackson County, and they all agreed to use the Lethality Assessment Program, the Maryland Model. The form that we came up with is part of your packet. The front part of the form is the Maryland Model form. It cannot be changed. It's a series of questions that we ask on the scene. Depending on the answer to those questions, it can trigger the protocol for us to call a dedicated cell phone line that goes to a specially trained advocate that is, there's someone there 24 hours a day to engage that survivor in services. It works approximately 80% of the time to get them on the phone when we call them. The phone call is less than 10 minutes and does not cause an exorbitant amount of time to be spent by the officer while that survivor is engaging with those services. What we also included, because our probation department uses the ODERA and so does our district attorney's office, is I came up with a supplemental form that we attach to the Maryland Model form. On that form, we have the ODERA questions that the officer can ask on the scene and very easily get from the survivor if she's willing to talk at the time. That way, another employee doesn't have to try and glean through the police report to obtain the information. It's real simple. They look at the back and they look at the questions on the back. ODERA is used by our parole and probation department for supervision of the offenders. So what we're doing on the scene to help the survivor is a lethality screening, not a reoffense screening. The Maryland model is used in 34 states as of 2015. Between 2008 and 2013, Maryland had a 32% drop in their homicide cases for the entire state. Again, this lethality assessment program through Maryland is the same concept that we practice in Medford, which is the same concept in Salem. The officer engaging the survivor beyond arrest and getting them in touch with services. That's what this particular program's about. The other part that we're going to add is the danger assessment through Dr. Jacqueline Campbell and the Jeannie Geiger Crisis Center. We're going to bring them out and start what's called a high-risk team, and there's versions of it in the state. That's designed for post-arrest, pre-conviction, while they're currently incarcerated. It takes the worst of the worst by using her danger assessment after we've used the other ones to determine the very highest lethality, which would then be targeted with no matrix, no bail, ankle monitoring, daily check-in at probation, things of that nature to reduce the likelihood of lethality. So there's a few different things we're talking about here. We're talking about the recidivism screenings that maybe probation uses. The one I'm talking about that we implemented throughout Jackson County is a lethality screening, and the design is to ask that survivor questions like, has they ever threatened to kill you? And they're having to listen to these questions and answer them, so they're getting a better understanding of their own lethality through a few questions on a piece of paper asked by a police officer in just a couple minutes. And the goal is then to, like I said, provide them with services. All the trainings I've been to, when you talk to Jeannie Geiger, when you talk to the Maryland model, all of their studies have shown when you can get a survivor to engage in services, they are much more likely to get out of that relationship, and it's much less likely that they will be the victim of a homicide. The last part I wanted to talk about as it relates to the lethality screening is strangulation, although that's not part of what we're going to talk about with this bill. They go hand in hand. One of the highest indicators of lethality is strangulation. When you look at police departments, if I were to use the carotid restraint, as it was called in the past, I am using deadly force. I have to be authorized to shoot that person if I'm going to use a carotid restraint. If someone uses a carotid restraint or tries to strangle me, I'm authorized to pull out my gun and shoot them. So what you have when you have strangulation is you have people using deadly force on the person they're abusing every single time they do it. The last thing I'm going to talk about is the part where you don't have to sell this to the community. I've done many public speaking engagements. I don't even have to look at the people behind me. There are victims of domestic violence in this room. Every speaking engagement I go on, I have people come up and talk to me and thank us for what we're doing, because in decades past, law enforcement has failed to do their duties and protect victims of domestic violence. That's changing. And this is not something where you're going to have an opposition group saying we shouldn't be helping out victims of domestic violence. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Who's going to go next?
I'm Lisa Swart. And I would like to speak about the success that other states have had with lethality assessments. And one particular county, using the Maryland model, went from, they reduced their lethalities to nothing. Since they have implemented it, they have not had a single lethality. And what they have done, though, is since 2005, they have put high response interventions into the most lethal situations 129 times. And so what you have are thousands and thousands of DV calls in the state of Oregon every day, and we have limited resources. It's a screening tool. Which are the cases that we need to actually really look at that will save lives? And one of the reasons it's important is just in human terms, because we're talking about people's lives. And then you can also look at money. Each lethality costs approximately $2 million in accrued costs. So in Oregon, if we can adopt these models statewide in a mandatory manner, that would save about 10 deaths per year, which would be $20 million per year that we would be saving if we implement this type of a program. And one of the key components of this is that there is sharing through within the agencies. The judicial system needs to know from an objective perspective, this person poses a high risk. And last session, you passed SB 788, which was particularly to inform the judges about DV issues. And that was put in place in part to, as part of this situation, we're trying to get all the pieces together. Because if the judges know which people are at risk of killing their children or their partners, then they can take more seriously the requests for supervised visitation, and there's some objective analysis to back them up. They're not doing it just based on their own personal feeling, the vibe they're getting. There's an objective decision. As we heard, the parole officers, the DAs, they know which cases are more likely to result in deaths, and they can focus their higher attention on this. And I speak as a survivor of strangulation, and when I told the police that I was strangled, the doctor told police. It was a physician that called and got my husband arrested. They released him within 20 minutes after they booked him in. So the first place he came was straight to me and said he would kill me if I testified against him. And on that record of the police reports, he said he's going to kill us, and so forth. So basically, all the screenings that would have been on a lethality assessment were there. But back then, they weren't doing lethality assessments. So this is one case that it would have saved lives, saved money, saved trauma. And that's why I'm here, because I want other people not to have to go through the trauma that our family has endured.
Thank you. First, I want to thank Senator Hansel, who is not in the room today, but we did visit with him before we came because he was and is the sponsor for this bill, and we really are indebted to him. And I want to thank you for letting us present today. The power of what both our police officer, Bob, and our survivor, Lisa, have testified to cannot be ignored or cannot be minimized.
Louise, I need to go ahead and put your name on the record, please.
Oh, I didn't put my name on?
Not.
Well, you insist. Okay, I'm Louise Bouchard, and I'm the director of Voices Set Free.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay. We have so many victims, similar to Lisa, who are willing to testify to this body. We are a group who really believe that the voices of those who are silent need to be brought forward, and they would be very happy to be part of our hearings. We believe the change is possible, and that the power held within this hearing today will impact the standing of Oregon's status. We have the second highest incidences of domestic and sexual assault within this nationwide. We realize that has to change. You are the leaders of this beautiful state. It is incumbent on you to protect our families, especially our children, so that they will not suffer lives full of the tragedy and suffering of abuse. Many people will benefit from your vote to improve greater public safety through a statewide intervention that saves lives. We also have been in touch with the sheriff of Clackamas County, Craig Roberts. He would have also joined us today. He's had his lethality assessment in place for 3 years, and it's now countywide. But he had another trip to Washington, D.C., but he would join us too, as we've been able to get our police officer today. We're so grateful for him spending the time with you, because I think the education has to come from the folks who live this world and are in it. We await a better future, and we thank you for listening.
And I would also like to add that we have Samantha Parrish also with us. She is both a survivor and also a police officer, so she knows both sides of this situation, and she's also available to answer questions.
And the advocate for...
All right. So let me see if there's questions. I do have some for the detective, but I'll see if there's any other questions. Regarding the training for Medford, can you just give us a ballpark about... was this an in-service type training that you did to bring the rank and file up, and about how much time did it take, and whether there's been any outreach to DPSST to put this into the general 16-week course?
So it's about $1,000 to get a trainer for the advocates. Myself and a district attorney became a train-the-trainer. We went to the briefings for the different departments in our county. There's a video that lasts 19 minutes, and there's about a 25-minute PowerPoint discussion. There's no added cost to the department unless they have to pay for officers to come in on overtime to give the training. My department had to spend a little bit of money to pay me overtime to conduct the training. However, should Maryland get refunded, and they'll know in October, they have grants where they will fly everyone out and they'll train everyone, and it's free. And then you have the cost of the telephone to the advocacy agency, and potentially the advocacy agency having to employ a person to answer that telephone. Obviously, it would be multiple people because you have 24 hours a day. But the cost for Maryland is really very minimal compared to some of the others.
All right.
In the packet is the cost for Clackamas the first year and the 3 years. $22,000 was their first year's cost.
Okay, thank you. Any questions, follow-ups? Thank you all very much for presenting today. We appreciate your time.
We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And I did say that Ryan said that he would be available if there was any questions that came up from this panel. Since there weren't any questions, I'm assuming there's no follow-ups for him. All right. Ryan, thank you very much for standing by. Our next presentation is going to be on the review of the Pew MacArthur Results First Initiative and Oregon Criminal Justice Commission findings. So we have four individuals that are scheduled. I'm going to ask all of them if they can come up. Mike, I think we'll need another chair if we're going to have everyone.
Real quick, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Hi, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is Kristen Pendergrass.
I wish I was in Hawaii or something. I don't know. It's good afternoon. Sorry
Hi.
For me.
Did I say morning?
I did.
Members of the committee, my name is Kristen Pendergrass with the Pew MacArthur Results First Initiative. As many of you know, I'm a former Oregon legislative staffer, and my experience here has made me very familiar with the challenge you all face in policymaking. Budgets and policies are often created based on inertia. We've funded something at this level forever, so we're just going to keep doing it, or based on anecdote. You know, my constituent comes in and says, my brother's cousin's nephew was really helped by this program, so you should fund it. And that's great, but what if that person is an outlier? Often you guys do not have access to enough data to tell you whether or not a program or a policy or a budget item is going to work. So here's our policy challenge. We have limited data on what works and what we're funding and what programs there are. So what is our solution? Many of you may be familiar with Moneyball. This is the story of the Oakland A's general manager, Billy Bean, who used data to create a better baseball team on a limited budget. And similarly, the results first approach allows states to achieve better outcomes without increased spending. So the results first approach has three phases. The first is to create a program inventory. This is where you make a list of all the programs you're funding. You collect data on how much you're spending on them, how many people you're serving, what the capacity is for these programs, and then you match this list of programs to the evidence base. Is there research out there that these programs are effective or not? Maybe there's no research at all. It's all important information to have on what you're funding. The next phase is the benefit cost analysis, where you're able to apply state-specific information to figure out which programs give you the best bang for your buck. And then finally, using your results to get better outcomes without increasing your spending. So in Oregon, the Criminal Justice Commission has applied the benefit cost analysis in adult criminal justice, and there's three steps to it. The first is to draw on the best research from around the country to identify what works. Next, this allows you to predict the impact here in Oregon. And then finally, use the model to calculate the long-term benefits and costs. So as I said, CJC has applied this in adult criminal justice, and they're working on the juvenile justice component as well. But the results first model is also available in currently 7 program areas, including substance abuse, mental health, child welfare, and the others you see. And we've actually recently partnered with OHSU and the Washington State Institute for Public Policy to begin building out the healthcare portion of the model. So that should be available in about a year. We currently work in 22 states around the country and 5 counties. And I want to stress that we're not a typical consulting model where we come in and take all your data, put it into a black box back in D.C., and come back with a report 6 months later that ends up adding to the stack on your desk of all the reports you guys get. We're really a capacity-building initiative. We work with the staff in the jurisdiction, so here in Oregon, to train them to populate and customize the model so that it's applicable and useful to you all. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Mike Schmidt, who's going to talk about the history of the program here in Oregon.
Chair Brzezinski, Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Mike Schmidt. I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. And I just wanted to give you a little history of how this got started. Many of you have been working on or were a part of the passage of House Bill 3194 in 2013. That legislation tasked the Criminal Justice Commission with developing a cost-benefit tool that we could use in our public safety system. So since that time, and working with the Public Safety Task Force, we partnered with the Results First Initiative, which is funded by the Pugh MacArthur Foundation, and we've been doing this work since then. To my left, Dr. Ann Lehman, our staff criminologist at the CJC, has been actually doing the work. But I just wanted to kind of give you that history, that this is really coming out of the justice reinvestment work that we've been doing. So we're really excited to have something here to show you. It's our hope by presenting to this committee and meeting with some of you individually and presenting to other committees that this type of analysis could be used in other areas across the state to help you all make decisions. So with that, I will hand it over to Dr. Ann Lehman.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker, Chair Brzezinski, and members of the committee. And as Mike said, I'm Dr. Ann Lehman, and I'm the staff criminologist for the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. I'm very happy to be here today to share the results of this project we've been working on. I know when we talk about benefit cost analysis, it can be a little dry sometimes, so feel free to interrupt me if you have any questions. So we've been working with DOC, OIA, and some of the community corrections agencies around the state to get Oregon-specific data so we can put it into this model. And we know that the results that we're getting are specific to Oregon, so we know that it's directly relevant to us. So the data that we get includes Oregon's 10-year recidivism patterns measured several different ways, data specific to the sentencing practices and the average sentences that are served, cost of Oregon's criminal justice system, and the cost of our programs. So when we talk about programs, we're talking about ones that are working to change offender behavior, specifically to reduce recidivism. So once we've measured, we can put this together to kind of measure the cost of recidivism and combine that with the average reduction in recidivism you get from these programs, which we know based on national research. So we combine that to know if the programs are cost-effective or not. So that avoided recidivism cost is the benefit side to the cost-benefit model. So we have four programs to share results for you today. These are all DOC programs, so they're run in the prisons. We're also working on getting some programs in the community corrections and juvenile justice as well. But we wanted to go ahead and present this to you today so that you are aware of this work and so that you can consider if this is something that might be useful to you in other policy areas. These aren't the only DOC programs as well. We're still working on a few others, but for now, we have four program categories. Each of these represents multiple programs. They may be run in different prisons, and we combine them together because that makes sense. And vocational education includes things like hair design, welding, and computer technology. The benefits column is the avoided recidivism cost due to the effectiveness of the program. Each of these numbers represents one person going through the program. It's assuming if you send a group through the program, they're kind of averaging the benefits out across everyone, those avoided crime benefits. This is divided into taxpayer benefits, which is anything paid for by federal, state, or local dollars, non-taxpayer benefits, which is the victimization costs, the avoided victimization costs, such as property damage or medical expenses, and then finally, the cost is the cost of running one person through the program. I'm going to skip ahead to the benefit to cost ratio because I think that this is the most powerful tool that we get out of this. Makes it really easy to compare programs against each other. It's kind of a systematic language for looking at them. So I'm going to give you a little context for interpreting this number. Anything below zero, if we had a benefit cost ratio below zero, that would mean that the program is actually harmful. It actually increases recidivism. So it's really good that we don't have any of those on our list. Anything between zero and 99 cents would indicate that the program is effective, but has such a small impact on recidivism, or it's just so expensive that you're not getting back the money that you're investing in it. So all of these are over a dollar. All of them would be considered cost effective. The lowest one we have on our list tells us for every dollar invested in inpatient or intensive outpatient drug treatment, we're avoiding $5.12 worth of avoided crime costs. So this is a really good return on investment. So I'm going to hand it over to Heidi Stewart, who's going to talk a little bit about how DOC plans to use these results.
So good afternoon, Chair Prozonsky, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Heidi Stewart. I'm the Assistant Director of the Offender Management and Rehabilitation Division with the Oregon Department of Corrections. As a department, we continually strive to improve efficiency and effectiveness, and this includes our programs. We want them, obviously, to be cost-effective and to be efficient. And so in making decisions on what programming to provide to offenders, it's oftentimes difficult to really know and to determine the value of what we're buying or what we're investing in. So as the Criminal Justice Commission refines the results first benefits cost model, it can provide tangible information to us on the expected return on investments for the programs that we fund. So going forward, we can use the data as this tool is making better informed decisions on how we designate funds towards programs and thereby maximizing taxpayer dollars. Thank you.
Wow, that's quick. All right, questions? Representative Greenlick first.
Thank you. When you look at a program in terms of investing now and getting downstream benefits in dollars, put a dollar in now and get $5 over the next 20 years or something, do you actually take money out of the budget? I mean, do you actually retrieve some of those cost savings as a part of your budgeting process?
They're cost avoided. It's money that we would be spending if we didn't run the programs.
But then do you take that money out of the future budgets if I follow? It's one thing to say I've had a lot of experience in other areas where a department will come in and say, if you give us $1 million, we'll save you $5 million in somebody else's budget. And we say to somebody else's budget, can we take the $5 million out of your budget? And they say, hell no, we don't have enough money to do what we're doing now. So, I mean, is that cost avoidance really avoided? Can we reduce the prison budget by a certain amount?
Keep it from growing.
Maybe.
This one?
While they're putting that up, I mean, one of the things about cost avoidance, the way we've seen it most recently, is actually being reinvestment, justice reinvestment back at the county level. In fact, we had a meeting this on Monday talking about what our number is going to be based on that. And if I remember correctly, we think the cost avoidance is going to be 52 point something million based on the criteria. So we'll see if we can get a little bit more. But so actually, it looks like we're going to take that money that should or could have been used in the DLC application.
We reduced the prison budget then. Actually,
shifting that into other uses to the local level to help combat the issues at the either reentry or even pre-entry in the programs.
So, chairs and representative, the cost savings, and Ann can explain this much better than I can. That you see from the charts that were up here, they're not cost avoidance directly to the Department of Corrections, but to the criminal justice system as a whole.
Okay. Yes, chairs and representative. The cost avoided, it's actually only a small portion of those that comes out of DOC's budget, because the costs that we're avoiding, it's really cost to society. The biggest part of that is victimization costs, and that's really important because that's what's keeping our society safe. When we look at recidivism, we're looking at cost of the arrest, the cost of the prosecution, the cost of community supervision, the cost of prison, and the cost of jails, and the cost of post-prison supervision. So with all of those, the part of that would come from the DOC's budget is pretty small. Thank you.
Follow one more.
Yes.
So we will have fewer prosecutors then, because they'll have to prosecute less. We'll have we'll reduce the jail cost. I mean, is there actually any cost? Is that cost a symbolic reduction, or is it really save somebody some money?
Chair Brzezinski, Chair Barker, Representative Greenlick, I can answer part of that. At least the goal from the Results First Initiative point of view is not to reduce costs. It's to allow you to better invest the funds that you are already dedicating towards programs that work better. And in terms of the cost saving, I think this graph shows that it's in the future. So, and as Ian said, it's to the society writ large and the criminal justice system as a whole. So I'm not sure if you could exactly take out that one piece out of a line item or out of a department's budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Any other follow-up questions? Ladies, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. I think that concludes the individuals for this review. And our next one is going to be payment of towing and storage fees on recovered stolen vehicles. We have two panels that are going to be presenting. Aaron Knott and Ashley Meade are going to start, and y'all two would come on up. Aaron, I'll give you the lead. And then we'll have a second panel afterwards that will give us a little bit more, I think, insight as to direct impact on individuals that are faced with this situation.
And thank you, Chair Brzezinski, Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name's Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Attorney General. But before that, I was a prosecutor. And for part of that period, I worked in the Property Crimes Division. And that meant that I came into contact with a lot of people who had had their cars stolen. And so I heard their stories. And something I heard consistently is that while the fact of getting your car stolen can completely decimate your life, getting it back can be, if not as bad, definitely more complicated than it should be. And so it helps to understand sort of the typical facts of a stolen car. Now, when your car is stolen, how it comes back to you, if it comes back to you, that can really vary. In the best case scenario, you get your car back right away, and you get it in substantially the same shape it was in when it left. I've even heard stories of stolen cars being returned to the very parking spot from which they were taken. But you also get cars wrapped around trees, filled with contraband, undrivable, and unusable to you. And so when your car is recovered, that starts a process.
Usually, in fact, almost always, your car is discovered by law enforcement. You made a stolen report that made your car stolen, and so when they find it, they refer back to your report, and that's how they know that the car was the subject of theft. Now, across the state, when your car is found, the law enforcement officer will try to contact you, and that's usually going to be a phone call to the number you left with them when you reported the car is stolen. But cars are not returned on your schedule. The car could come back at 4 in the morning. It could come back while you're at work. Or, and this is often the case, it could come back when you can't get to where it is because, well, you don't have a car. And most law enforcement agencies will try to stay with your car as long as they can. 60 minutes seems to be something of a floor across the state. But we need to be realistic. In some parts of the state, that law enforcement officer who's standing on the side of the car with the side of the road with your car might be the only law enforcement officer for 50 miles. And he or she is getting calls, 911 calls, really serious things while standing with your vehicle. So eventually that car is towed. And so when a tower comes out and recovers that vehicle, law enforcement passes some information to the tower. What information that is seems to be inconsistent. I've heard some stories that tow companies show up and they're merely told, tow this car, not given any additional context. Some are given quite a bit of context. But in any event, your car is then towed. That starts to trigger expenses. Towing, of course, isn't free. And those expenses can really vary. If your car is recovered in the city from which it was stolen, good. The towing distance is shorter. But if it's recovered 20, 30, 100 miles away from you, in a rural area, the towing expenses can be much higher. So once that is in the possession of the tower, they will eventually try to get a hold of you, and I have every reason to believe they do it as fast as they can, but they may need to be researching who you are on their own, going to DMV records and doing other such due diligence. Time passes, and as time passes, the fees on your car become more and more expensive. Now, if you can't pay to get your car out of the tow, eventually that moves to an auction situation. The tow will sell off your car, and then in some cases they'll write it off, and at least in some other cases they'll pursue the difference between your recovered car and the fees they accrued against you. So your car is stolen and you end up ultimately paying for the overages of the tow cost. And that doesn't end things. Even if you get the car back, you might be missing the plates off the front. The title may have been stolen out of the glove box, so now you have to go to DMV and face a brand new sort of wave of expenses and logistical difficulties, all of which continue to drive up your expenses for a decision that you never made, that is, the decision that your car be stolen. So I'm mostly here to tee this up for you. You'll be hearing from Ashley Beatty sitting to my right. She's the director of the Victims Assistance Program in Deschutes County. She'll give her perspective on how common and severe this is. And then you'll hear from several civilians who will share their stories with you. And I want to emphasize, everyone understands that this is the livelihood of tow companies. They need to make a profit in towing cars. That's the reason that they exist. They're for profit, and they should be. But I think we can ask some legislative questions. One, are they getting all the information they need to notify victims swiftly enough? Two, when they get that information, are they acting on it? How sufficient is the notice we're giving victims, especially if they're going to be facing fees that accrue on a daily basis after the car has been received by the yard? And finally, while we understand that towing companies must charge a fee for their services, it is appropriate to ask if those fees are in balance, especially for crime victims that, again, never made the decision to have their car towed in the first place. The Department of Justice anticipates working with towers, law enforcement, crime victims, cities and counties in the months to come to bring back a legislative proposal. We don't have that now. This is mostly just to help you understand the issue. So with that, I'll be open for questions and I'll turn it over to Ms. Beatty.
Hi, thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Ashley Beatty and I'm the program coordinator for the Victims Assistance Program in Bend, Oregon, so Deschutes County. And I'd like to tell you about a gentleman that we had the pleasure of working with earlier this year. So his car was unfortunately stolen from an employee parking lot. His car was then later found by Oregon State Police when they pulled the gentleman over who had stolen it. That car was then towed and impounded, and I'd like to share just an overview of what his bill was that he received. He got a towing service charge of $150. He had a storage fee of $50 a day for 3 days, because mind you, he was out of state. He got charged $6 per mile for 19 miles to total $84 to tow that. He had to pay a dispatch charge of $30. He had to pay $80 of labor at the scene. He had to pay $250 for the winching and recovery of his car. He had to pay $75 for the DMV's fee that they charged the tow company for the request of their information. In the end, just to recover his car, he had to pay $969 was the bill that he was given. Our office worked with the tow company. They did give a discount, but he ended up having to pay $794 to get his car out of impound. And the thing that's most impactful for these victims is that this is a substantial amount of money, and they have to work to get the money saved up to get their car out of impound. But in Deschutes, which has very rural areas, you have to travel in your car to get to work to get your car out of impound. So it's this just cycle, and there's not necessarily public transportation to help these victims get to work. So the burden is just so incredible on them. This is something that I'm very passionate about, obviously. And since the fall of last year, we've had 6 cases in which vehicles have been stolen and 4 victims have been impacted by either impound, tow costs, and only one was so lucky to get her car back and not have to pay towing and impound fees. So it's just, it's a substantial problem, and any change that we can make is going to be a positive impact on the community.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Gelser first.
Thank you. Does your car insurance cover any of these losses?
I could tell you about another gal. So the towing, no, because usually that's coming from the police department, so Oregon State Police is towing, or whichever company is towing it. We had another gal who had to pay the $500 for her towing, but then her insurance company did tow her car from the impound lot because she was one of the unfortunate ones who picked her car up from impound and found out that it had been totaled. So after she paid the $500 to have her totaled car taken to storage, she then had to have her insurance company pay to tow that car, and that car is now sitting on her property useless.
But the insurance company won't total it out like it would in a crash.
Are you talking about the victim's insurance or the offender's insurance?
The victim's insurance.
They only paid in that one instance for the tow from the tow yard to her house.
Probably depend on what type of coverage you had,
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
If you had straight liability coverage, you wouldn't. But if you had theft.
Okay.
Yeah, and Chair Przanski, Senator Gelser, I wanted to respond to that effect. In canvassing victims and hearing these stories, the answer does seem to be it depends. The unfortunate conclusion, of course, that creates is that it's our poorer citizens who tend to bear the expense more heavily.
All right. Senator Thatcher, then.
I guess my question was along similar lines, and this work group that you're going to have maybe include insurance companies? Wondering about that. I know, sure. It would depend on all that, and it is a hassle to have your car stolen, and it seems like many cases when people do have full coverage, not really poor people probably, but when you have the full coverage, then if it isn't recovered at all, this insurance would kick in. So it seems like if it is recovered, that would be less of a cost to them to pay for the towing. I don't get it. I just think they should be part of the conversation.
I assume DCBS is going to be part of that.
Chair
Przanski, yes. The insurance commission. Chair Barker.
You know, I just was going to share a couple of things. So I was in the state police a million years ago, and there was a case up in Clatsop County where it was a drunk driver that got stopped. And he said, please don't tow my car, because if you just leave it here, I'll come back and get it. I can't afford the tow. So they agreed to do that. And then he came back and his car's on blocks and the wheels are gone. He sued the state police, and they made the officer actually pay him, because they said, you have the liability, that you take somebody away. And then another friend of mine in Chicago, near a suburb, had his car stolen, and his car he loved, this old guy, his Cadillac, he washed the engine. And so the police call him up, and they said, we found your car. And he was delighted. And he said, I'll come get it. And they said, no, wait. We're going to sit on it because we think they're going to come back and get it, and we'll arrest them. they got called off in an emergency, and when they came back, the car was stripped to the bone. Mm-hmm. Everything was gone. So, I mean, that's why the police end up towing those pretty rapidly.
Yeah.
But these things are horrific that are happening.
Other questions for this panel? All right, we're going to hear from the other three. And while they're coming up, I will say that this came to my attention. Cindy Will Dwyer, who used to be a county commissioner in Lane County, she has an individual who she helps as a senior citizen who had this situation occur where she lives in a senior setting, and her car was stolen out of that parking lot. And we heard what some of the expenses are. And it was one of those situations that because she had an advocate really working hard, they were able to reduce some of the costs, but some of the stuff just didn't make a lot of sense, such as $50, if I remember correctly, for hazardous fee, and that was basically to supposedly clean the car of syringes and stuff that was left in it, but all of those syringes and everything was still in there, but she still had that as one of her charges. Mm-hmm. So if we could have the next panel come forward, and that is Laura Mandel, Yolanda Ramirez, Gonzalo de Santiago.
Yes, correct.
Yeah, thank you. And I'm not sure if you've been here before to give testimony, but if before each of you testify, if you would just tell us your name for the record and tell us your story, please.
Okay. My name is Laura Mandel. I live in Portland. And in 2005, in July, I had just graduated from college and I bought my first car. It was a used 1990 Toyota Camry, so nothing fancy. Already 15 years old at that point, but I had saved up $1,800 and basically spent all the money I had on this new car. 3 months later, in October, my dad happened to be visiting from Minnesota, and I went out to the parking lot to show my dad excitedly my new car and kind of said, where's my car? My car was gone. And it had been parked in the apartment complex parking lot, which is well lit. I had a parking permit for it. I had never had any concerns about parking my car there. All of a sudden, it was gone. So after determining that it had not been towed by the apartment complex, I made a report to the police at about 11 a.m. that morning. And they told me that they would give me a call back if they heard anything or found my car. At about 6 p.m. on that same day, I got a call back from the police, and they said, "We found your car. It's been towed by Retriever Towing. And you have to go pick it up from Retriever Towing." And so I called Retriever and verified that indeed it was at their lot, got directions to their lot, and was informed that I was going to have to pay $200 to get it out of their tow lot. And I called the police back and said, "They're telling me I have to pay $200 to get my stolen car back, and it was gone less than 24 hours. And the police said, "Sorry, there's nothing we can do." So I was incredibly fortunate that my dad happened to be visiting at the time, because I was able to borrow money from him to get my car back. Turns out my battery had been taken out because I didn't have anything in the car to steal. I had a tape deck.
That's a
which,
classic.
You know, they didn't take, but I had nothing to steal. And so they apparently saw fit to take my car battery, so I had to replace that and pay $200. But if I had been in a different situation and had fewer financial resources, I don't know what exactly would have happened, but I was told by the towing company that there was, I believe, a $50 fee for storage every single day I left my car there and didn't retrieve it. So I felt like I was victimized by having my car stolen, and then victimized again by having to pay to get my own car back.
Well, thank you. So I believe Yolanda Ramirez is going to be testifying, and is your brother who will be
brother-in-law.
Brother-in-law will be translating for us. Thank you very much for being here.
My name is Yolanda Ramirez, and I'm going to be translating for my brother-in-law.
Oh, I apologize. We had it the other way.
Gonzalo de Santiago. Who on the and we're going to also talk about a car that was stolen from him. It was in April that they took the car, like about on the 10th or 10th.
Lo llevaron como los 8 días.
And, you know, what had happened was it was taken on a Saturday. He wasn't notified until Monday. It was totaled. It was wrapped around. Estaba chocado.
La grúa quería que pagara $515.
And the towing company wanted him to pay $515.
Más 45 diario.
Plus $45 a day.
Yo le dije que no es mi culpa. El culpable está en la cárcel.
He said it wasn't my fault. The culpable person has been arrested and is in jail.
Es la segunda vez que me roban un carro.
It's the second time they've taken a car from him.
La primera vez no encontraron los culpables.
The first time they couldn't find the people capable.
Yo pagué por todo.
He paid all costs.
En este caso sí encontraron al culpable.
And in this case, they found the culpable person.
Él es el que debe de pagar por todo, no yo. Y yo no tengo trabajo. No trabajo desde el año pasado.
And he's been disabled since last year, so he's not working. And I think the total cost that he incurred, besides the loss of the vehicle that he had just put $1,500 in, putting in a new alternator, putting on new tires, and the $45 a day that are still being accrued because the towing company wouldn't take the title, even though the car was totaled. And so it's still accruing. I think right now he's at about $6,000 in debt. So...
Y la grúa no me dejó sacar ni un papel
and
de emergencia.
The towing company wouldn't even let him go in and take out his, you know, his doctor's papers, his records, you know, nothing. They wouldn't let him go in.
Yo tenía que comprobar para ir a disability.
And he had to go to, you know, his papers were for disability.
Y no me dejó sacar ni esos
and
papeles.
He didn't even let him take the papers that he needed to do that. And so where it stands right now is he doesn't have a car, and has a lot of work-related type injuries that he's accrued. And the only reason, and I told him, because I always tell even my children, I'll pay full coverage. I don't care what your car costs, because in the end, it's going to cost me a lot more. I know, because I've had to represent people that this has happened to before. And he said, but Yolanda, the car would not have been worth me paying $50 extra for a car that isn't worth it. It was just getting me from point A to point B. It would be like buying a new car for me. I could not afford that. And
no vale la pena.
He says it's not worth that.
Y hay un deductible de $500. El carro está viejito, pero yo le metí muchas cosas nuevas. Pero ellos no miran eso.
He said, and even though the car was old, he had put so much money into it just so that, you know, he could run it. But, you know, he says nobody can really see that. Mm-hmm. And so, unfortunately, this has been devastating for him because he has good credit. And now this is also on the line, too. So it's even jeopardized that because he has no job. There's no way that he can, you know, take it out or, you know, borrow that kind of money from anybody. He said if they want to put me in jail because I owe them, they're going to have to do that because that's the only thing that he can do.
No tengo para pagarle.
Yeah, he said, just doesn't have to pay.
Ahora, otra cosa, él cometió un error. La persona que está en la cárcel cometió un error, debe de pagar.
And he feels that people that commit those crimes need to make restitution.
Yo cometo errores, yo los pago. He pagado errores.
He said, if he commits errors, he pays for them. And he's done that in the past. And so it's really affected his mental status. He's extremely depressed about this because he figures it's a very unjust system because the car was found right inside of Dallas and yet that was, you know, an exorbitant towing fee. And it happened to another friend of mine that his car caught fire. They called, the police and they too told them, you know, just call somebody, give them your title, and they'll take care of that. They charged him $1,000, and they said they had to hook up towing winches, and they had to clean the car of debris, and even though the firefighters
put the broken glass on the carpets in the car. So it's a horrible situation because there are no guidelines as to how much they can charge you. You're at their mercy. Whatever they say, and if they won't take a title, they're not going to let you have anything, and they're going to continue to charge you until they can get rid of the car.
No quiso title, dijo que quería dinero.
He wanted the money. Right. He had a family to support, so no title.
Y yo le dije que yo también perdí mi carro ya.
And he said he had already lost his car, but that's our story.
Okay. A question. I understand that the tow company still has the car, mm-hmm. and they're still assessing daily penalties?
Mm-hmm. Todavía están cobrando.
Me mandaron una carta registrada diciéndome que todavía estaban cobrando.
He said they sent him a registered letter telling him it's still accruing debt.
So they have not turned this over to collections at this point?
Not that he knows of. And he said just in the tow alone, you know, the accrued cost is over $3,000 just in the towing.
Just in the towing.
Yeah.
I believe it sounds like a change. It used to be like you could sign off your title if you didn't do that, they would put what they call a mechanics lien on the car, and they would take that value even though they wouldn't get thousands of dollars.
Right.
But they wouldn't keep accruing it on somebody.
And he said he wouldn't take the title. He said he wanted money.
Yeah.
We'll see if we can maybe have a response.
Yeah.
Questions?
That's terrible. Yeah. Thank you.
Any questions? Other additional questions? Thank you very, very much for coming forward. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
So, Aaron, would you be so kind, maybe come up to the table just so we can have a little dialogue?
Like in the parking lots in
Portland, yes, please.
They would wait for those. You'd pull in to run into a store. Boom, they hook you up. Way you go.
So I know that your agency is looking at this. I'd like for you to keep the co-chairs advised as to how the work group's going. As I mentioned, I know I have constituents. We probably all have constituents that are being impacted this way. And it seems to me that maybe we should ask, I don't see them in the room now, but some of the individuals that are representing some of the tow companies to maybe formalize some type of response to us. So, Mr. Co-Chair, if possible, maybe we could have a follow-up before we start the 2017 session to see what the legislation looks like, and also to give the individuals that have been discussed today an opportunity to maybe give a rebuttal.
Sure. Mr. Chair, we passed something regulating tow companies.
We have done more than that. We've done a couple of different ones, and it still seems like these are the exceptions or situations that continue to come forward that we don't know about or we try to deal with. I mean, when you hear the stories that we've heard today, and I can only tell you the one that I've heard from one of my constituents is not quite as bad as what we've heard from Mr. San Diego, but it's pretty egregious.
It's terrible.
So,
Chair Przanski, I think the Department of Justice will also spend a little bit more time with Mr. DeSantiago's specific case.
So please.
We'll be in touch.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, that concludes the informational hearing that we had on the towing and storage fees. Our last of our presentations for today is dealing in the area of shackling of juveniles in court proceedings. And let's see, it looks like we got four different. We're going to bring up separate. Okay. So, Mark and Amy, why don't y'all come forward? I think you're going to tee up everything for us. Okay. And then we will have a phone conversation with Dr. Marty Beyer, then Judge Collins and Paula Lawrence will be after that, and then Judge Welch and Roxanne Scott. Thank you.
We're running a bit ahead of schedule.
That's quite all right. We like running ahead of schedule.
I know. I'll do my best to continue in that vein. Is it fine for me to proceed?
Yes, it is.
Okay, thank you. Chair Przanski, Chair Barker, and members of the committees, my name is Amy Miller. I'm Deputy General Counsel at the Office of Public Defense Services, and am pleased to be here today to introduce a little bit about this topic and introduce the people that are going to be speaking following me. Oregon has a long
Oregon has long recognized the right of adult defendants to be free from physical restraints during criminal trials. This right is derived from common law, from the 5th and the 14th Amendments of the U.S. Constitution. Oregon courts have recognized elements of prejudice to shackled defendants, including infringement on the presumption of innocence and the dignity of judicial proceedings, inhibition with consultation with his or her attorney, and interference with his or her decision to take the stand as a witness. As a result, adult defendants have the right to appear without physical restraint unless there is evidence of an immediate and serious risk of dangerous or disruptive behavior. In 1995, the Court of Appeals extended this right to appear in court free from shackles to juveniles in the case State v. Milliken. The Court of Appeals in that case found that juveniles have the same right as adult defendants to appear free from physical restraints and that shackling of youth in court proceedings is a violation of the youth's constitutional right to due process and fair trial. In that case, the Court of Appeals cites to two factors. First, that shackling interferes with the youth's right to freely consult with their attorney. And second, that shackling is inconsistent with the rehabilitative purposes of the juvenile justice system. But since that time, from 1995, the issue of shackling juveniles has prompted much discussion, debate, and reform, both here in Oregon and all over the country. According to the National Juvenile Defender Center, 23 states have limited juvenile shackling through legislation, through court rule, or through case law. And Oregon is the only Western region state which has not limited indiscriminate juvenile shackling. And just for purposes of explanation, indiscriminate juvenile shackling means a routine and automatic shackling of juvenile defendants without an individualized determination. This process unnecessarily humiliates, stigmatizes, and traumatizes young people. It interferes with the attorney-client relationship. It runs counter to the presumption of innocence and draws into question the rehabilitative purposes of the juvenile court system. Juveniles are entitled to an adequate defense, to a fair trial, and to the presumption of innocence, all fundamental rights upon which indiscriminate shackling impedes. Despite the holding in the Milliken case, indiscriminate juvenile shackling during court proceedings continues in many Oregon jurisdictions. So in 2015, I surveyed juvenile attorneys in Oregon regarding the practice of shackling within their counties. And the results show about a 50-50 split. In 12 counties, 12 counties routinely and indiscriminately shackle youth during court proceedings, while in 10 counties, juveniles are rarely, if ever, shackled during court. Three counties shackle youth inconsistently, and six of Oregon's counties have written shackling policies. The inconsistency among counties, I think, is an indicator that safety and order can be maintained even in jurisdictions that limit shackling. So 20 years have passed, actually 21, since the Milliken holding. Attorneys, judges, and juvenile department staff have made a number of efforts to address shackling at the local level across the state. And today you're going to hear more about those efforts. You'll hear from Judge Collins and from Paula Lawrence, who is a juvenile attorney, both from Yamhill County, who will talk about the changes made in their county as a result of Ms. Lawrence's advocacy and Judge Collins' 2011 letter opinion on shackling. Judge Welch, retired Multnomah County judge and member of the Public Defense Services Commission, will describe observations based on her experiences as a judge, both in Multnomah County and as a Plan B judge who has presided in other jurisdictions. And you'll also hear from Roxanne Scott, an attorney in Clackamas County, about her advocacy efforts and how in Clackamas County youth continue to be routinely shackled. And Mark will describe how in Multnomah County, over the years, the use of shackling has ebbed and flowed based in part on efforts of local advocates. And the problem we've identified 21 years after this case is because these reform and reform attempts have been at the local level, shackling is still applied inconsistently across the state. I do want to call out, in addition to my written testimony that I've submitted for you, I pulled together a handout on shackling and courtroom safety that talks about how that process works in Oregon and around the country and provides specific examples of jurisdictions which have limited juvenile shackling while maintaining safety. And I've also submitted a number of other materials from the National Juvenile Defender Center.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mark.
Good afternoon, Chair Przanski and Chair Barker and members of the Judiciary Committees. For the record, my name is Mark McKechnie. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Rights and Justice. We are a nonprofit law firm representing court-appointed clients in primarily in Multnomah County and have been doing so for the past 41 years. We have several much more knowledgeable people than I am lined up to speak today, so I'm going to be very brief, but I wanted to add a few points more from a local perspective. As Ms. Miller pointed out, that in spite of the case law, practices at the local level continue to be inconsistent and shackling indiscriminate around the state. Many courts and counties lack written protocols and policies. And in Multnomah County, shackling practices have changed over time for a variety of reasons. But the bottom line is that there's never really been a clear written policy to guide those practices. So, for example, many of us remember a time when juvenile court counselors themselves went and escorted youth from juvenile detention up to the courtrooms, and they were unrestrained, and there were no incidents to speak of during that time. Eventually, the local sheriff's deputies took over the transport, and practices started to shift, and there was a single incident that stakeholders who recall point to several years ago where a youth tried to flee from the courtroom and there were minor injuries, and that led to a dramatic shift in practices where juveniles were much more likely to be restrained when they were brought into court, especially any courtrooms that were not directly attached to the secure holding area. They tended to be restrained, at least in leg restraints, if not full shackles. And then I would also note that Willamette Week did a story on this issue about a year ago, and I think because of the attention raised by that article, we're seeing a shift again where I think there's more scrutiny and more care taken now in decisions about shackling, and practices have shifted again. But again, these changes are not driven by policy decisions. They're driven by culture and recent events, and attention has shifted practices, and I'm sure that there's some of those same dynamics at play in other counties that also lack these policies. Fortunately, right now in Multnomah County, there is a recognition that a written policy is needed, and local stakeholders are working on that, and I'm cautiously optimistic that that will result in written policies that are consistent with the Milliken decision. But again, that's one county, and often these changes have happened one county at a time. In counties that currently have policies consistent with Milliken, they're often the result of litigation or strong local leadership on the issue, or a combination of the two. And the question we want to raise today in this hearing is whether Oregon should continue to allow these practices to vary so widely, both over time and from county to county, in spite of a clear legal decision on what essentially the law is already in Oregon. We question whether litigating this issue over and over again on a case-by-case and county-by-county basis is an efficient use of the resources that we all know are very limited, the court time and public safety resources that it takes to litigate these cases. And we'd welcome your feedback about potential statewide solutions for this issue. And before I close, I want to note, when we've talked about this with other stakeholders, the two main concerns we hear about implementing policies consistent with the case law are that it would require extra resources locally, for example, to supervise youth, and that it would increase the risk of incidents occurring where people would get hurt. And those are certainly concerns that we need to take seriously, but in jurisdictions both in Oregon and around the country who have implemented policies, they really haven't found that these concerns or predictions actually come true, that they find ways to change their practices within existing resources, and also find that there are not increases in injuries or other courtroom incidents as the result of changing these policies. In your materials, I provided one chart that compares the six counties that have the policies that Ms. Miller referred to with a sampling of other counties, basically some similarity based on geographic location and population. And I frankly was surprised to find that the six counties collectively that have these policies actually have much higher rates per capita of juveniles detained. So they detain 62% percent more youth on an annual basis per capita in those counties compared to the comparison counties. So I think it shows that when counties either choose to implement these policies or they're required to do so, they're able to do so regardless of other factors. So now, I know we're running a little bit early. My plan was to introduce Dr. Beyer. Mm-hmm. And do we know? We don't think she's available.
Okay,
so.
Well, why don't we go and go with the next panel?
Okay, so with that, I'll conclude, and glad to answer any questions.
All right. First, are there any questions for the two presenters at this point? All right, so what I would, I guess, do is go to the next panel. That would be up number three is Judge Welch and Judge Collins, unless you want me to. Am I missing something?
Yeah. Chair Przanski, I think
you're going with.
All right. Judge Collins and Paula. Okay, I apologize. For Judge Collins and Paula Lawrence.
Good afternoon, Chair Przanski and Barker. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on this issue. I'm Judge Collins, John Collins from Yamhill County. For some years, I was the presiding judge. I recently passed that on to someone else, but I still continue to have a very strong advocacy for improvements in the criminal justice system, including the juvenile justice system. I think one of the overall themes that we have adopted and should adopt, I think, are do no harm, much like the medical profession. We can end up doing practices, not even thinking about it as deeply as we should, and end up doing harm to juveniles and to adults. I call that jurogenic harm. It's equivalent to what in the medical profession is called iatrogenic harm. So this area of shackling is one of those areas for juveniles. With me is Paula Lawrence. Paula Lawrence is an exceptionally fine advocate for the rights of juveniles in my county and elsewhere. And it was through some of her actions that we took a very much closer look at this issue of restraints on juveniles. And it led to a 2011 opinion on my part. It's a 14-pager. Some of it addresses some issues beyond the restraint issue. But I know as legislators you have tons of stuff to read. But it at least, I think, shows an example of how we really drilled down and looked at all the issues and all the considerations and shaped a new policy. And essentially, the new policy is to follow the Milliken Law, and which we probably should have been doing all along. It tended to be somewhat inconsistent before, and I think ultimately we concluded that a lot of the restraint was not necessary and it's even harmful to the juveniles involved. So The case law calls for an individualized case-by-case determination as to whether restraint should be applied, and you have to consider a number of risk factors. It probably should be remembered that if the courts and the juvenile system are following the statutes on who gets into detention in the first place, you are generally dealing with youth who demonstrated some higher risk of flight or harm, but there are other people that are in the system in detention that where that determination has not even actually been made yet. So it's a very important consideration. We don't generally have juveniles in restraint in juvenile hearings. I think since we implemented this, I think there might have been two where we had some level of restraint. We also made a distinction between what I call shackling, which is the full belly chains and leg irons that are applied to the most hardened criminals in the adult system. And that is the approach that was used in our county, and it has been used in other counties. So we've also looked at if we do find a necessity for some level of restraint, can't it be something considerably less oppressive than the chain gang style restraints that were used before and are used now with adults. So I did allow juveniles to be brought to court in restraint, but it's not the shackling that I just described. It's some lesser level of soft restraints, and the I could take too much time if I tried to explain why I felt we could and should still do that in the juveniles through the hallways. But suffice it to say, a lot of it had to do with their coming to the courtroom in a public passageway. There are other people present. Juveniles, quite frankly, have some impulsivity factors you have to take into account. You may have victims in the hallways. And so that was the level of restraint that's still allowed in bringing juveniles to and from. Ms. Lawrence and I had a case fairly recently where we did something a little differently. We basically sealed off the hallway, and then with that, the person was brought directly to court. It was cumbersome because we had to clear out the hallways and the courtrooms to allow that to occur, but in that instance, it felt like it was the right thing to do, and that's the way we did it. So there was some, when that decision on my part was issued, there was some grumbling, I'll say, fear that some people are going to get hurt and juveniles are going to run off and this is going to be bad. And so I'm really happy to report to you some 5 or 6 years after that decision that we have had zero attempted escapes, no disruptions or safety issues under the policy outlined in that opinion, not in to and from court and not in court. And the opinion seems to leave room for a case where a juvenile might have to be even leg restrained. But to my knowledge, I've never done that since that opinion, and I don't think any other judge has either. There just hasn't been the extraordinary circumstance that might warrant that. One of the things I've observed, too, is I see, and Ms. Lawrence can probably comment on this better, but one of the reasons why restraints are harmful is the impact that you heard just described by the previous speakers. But it essentially has, and you'll definitely hear it from Dr. Byers if we're able to connect with her, but it can have tremendously harmful psychological effect on the youth involved, and both short range and long range, short range being the inhibition that it places on juveniles in terms of their comfort level in court. They're being treated like hardened criminals, and they think everybody else views them that way. Again, maybe somebody more expertise in psychology, especially amongst youth with developing brains and oftentimes coming from troubled families, would explain why that's a particularly important thing to take care of and address in the restraint issue. But I have seen the juveniles, in my opinion, seem to be a lot more clear-headed, a lot more willing to participate in their proceedings, a lot more conversant with their attorneys, a lot more willing to testify if that's an appropriate stage of the proceeding for them to do so. And so I, just from an observational standpoint, believe that the reduction on restraints has had a tremendous beneficial effect upon juveniles, and I know I, as a judge, feel a lot better about it because we're no longer doing that jurogenic harm that I spoke of earlier. I've had families express gratitude for our doing that. I know Ms. Lawrence, I'm sure, remembers one of the cases we had where the parents had not seen their youth for a while. They were in detention, and they were like 13 years old or something like that, particularly young juveniles. And the first vision that the parents got of their kids was them coming into court in the full restraints. This was prior to this decision. Very hard for the families as well as the youth. So for all those reasons, I'm very much in favor of a rational and effective and legal policy regarding the restraint of juveniles. And there is, I think, where the legislature might be able to help out is by making it more a matter of state policy and not something that generally is occurring county by county and sometimes case by case. So that's my input. Maybe Ms. Lawrence, you'd like to take it from there.
Oh, okay, thank you. Good afternoon to the chairs and the members. And thank you for letting me speak today. It's interesting that Judge Collins mentioned that case with the 13-year-old coming into court, because that really is what got me
Paula,
involved.
I need you to put your name on the record.
Oh, excuse me, Paula Lawrence, okay. An attorney from McMinnville, for the record. And so as I was saying, it was interesting that Judge Collins mentioned that, because that is actually the case that got me interested in juvenile law. I've been practicing criminal law for 25 years, but most of that time I was working as an adult attorney, as a prosecutor, and then later as a defense counsel. And then I got involved in that case, and I happened to be in courtroom, and it had a bit of a high profile, so the courtroom was full of people. There was actually even some press there. And these two young boys come in, shuffling in with the full leg irons, you know, clasped on each ankle, chain between, full belly chain. Then the chain goes up to the wrist. They're also handcuffed, and you hear the rattling. It's, you know, Judge Collins says about the chain gang. And there was a collective gasp in the courtroom when they saw those kids walk in. So it's something that when people kind of say, oh, well, you know, the kid got in trouble, they got himself there, you know, what's the big problem about, you know, shackles? They really do make a big difference with the perception of the kids' perceptions of themselves, and their perception of the judicial, you know, system. And when we're trying to, in the delinquency world, rehabilitate kids, not punish them, we're trying to do things so that we can treat the problem and have them go on to be good citizens, we need them to respect the system. And so that's one of the problems with the kids going in, where there hasn't been any kind of a specific finding that they did anything wrong. We all know about how young kids and teenagers, they like things to be fair. It isn't fair, right? Well, when they're chained up and brought into court and restrained like they're going to do something and they haven't done anything, some of these kids are, it's their very first time even in the system, but because of the level of charge that they have, they end up in detention and end up being brought to court in the shackles. They immediately perceive the system to be unfair. And then when you hear from Dr. Beyer, her affidavit was actually used in our case, and I've spoken with her in the past. I mean, she's going to say that the kids focus on, they obsess on, they feel those shackles. And even though in our county we've now moved to what we call the soft restraints, and the way I would describe those is it kind of made out of seatbelt material. It goes around the youth's waist, and then it has two loops. And then the kids' hands are kind of looped. I would say they kind of look like a little dinosaur like this, you know, with their hands looped to their waist. And that's how they're brought to court. It's not even close to as offensive as shackles and chains. It doesn't have the same visual identification as shackles and chains, but I think you'll see from Dr. Beyer's affidavit, and if she has the opportunity to testify, it still is binding the kids. It's still holding them, you know, it close and giving them the, I still believe, the impression that they're being restrained, like as if they're going to do something without there having been a specific, you know, finding that the youth is going to do something. Okay.
I hope it's okay to interrupt, but just to understand, when they are brought to court that way, there's quickly a finding is made whether or not they need to be restrained. 95% of the time now, the answer is no, and the restraints are removed. It's just that passageway between detention and the courtroom that might call for a little higher level of restraint.
Right, and that's true. So when they come into the courtroom, and this is another reason why it'd be great to have a law that would kind of settle it among the state and the counties, is that, for example, in our courtroom, in Judge Collins' court, when youth are brought into court with those restraints, the juvenile department knows that once they're in the courtroom, they're to take the restraints off of the youth if there's been a judicial finding that it's okay for that kid to appear in court without restraints. But we have three other judges where they don't do that. So when they go into their courtroom, the youth remain restrained, at least with these seatbelt things that I'm calling them, until they're up at council table, and at that time they're unlocked. So that's the kind of thing where policies or laws would make a big difference. And again, when I think we hear from Dr. Beyer, the part of the harm is from the restraining itself. So when we're restraining them part of the time, it's still a restraining, and it's still an issue as to that harm. And then one of the other things that I just kind of want to point out is that I think a lot of times people think that the kids that are in juvenile the delinquency court are all delinquents. And it's the same as with adults. You're innocent until proven guilty. If you're the charged for the very first time, sometimes because of the nature of the charge, again, the youth might be kept in detention. But we even have kids without you know, criminal juvenile history that are in, you know, in court, and so those are the same youth that are being restrained, and this would be across the state, that it's not all youth that have, you know, some type of a delinquency adjudicated background. Also, in Oregon, the judges are mandated that they're supposed to keep the kids in the least, you know, kind of the least restrictive environment. And so if a judge can release a youth from detention at all, you know, they will if there's an opportunity to do that. But if a kid is in detention and they're in a county where, you know, you're allowing the shackling or the restraints, then those kids are going to be held in restraint. But the reason why kids are held in detention are not always because of a dangerous reason about the kid. They're being held in detention because they don't have a place to go to. Maybe a family member might have been a named victim in their crime, so they can't go to their home. They don't have any grandparents that live in the area, so they have no place to go. Maybe it's a youth that the judge would want them to have a GPS, like an ankle bracelet on, but the family doesn't have the money to be able to pay for that. There's, you know, as I said, there's more than just the youth is a danger, you know, to themselves or to the public, reason why a youth might be being kept in detention while they're waiting for their case to be litigated. And under Oregon law, they can have up to 58 days to bring a youth to trial. So that's 58 days, and every 10 days there's a detention review hearing where that youth, you know, will come to court. And depending, again, depending on the county, would be in shackles or in our case, at least transported in restraints until they get to the courtroom. So, as I said, when the comment I hear the most, as I said, about shackling, or when we were doing our case, we were actually somewhat pilloried in the press. There was letters to the editor and editorials and that kind of thing that were going on at the time, is that, you know, people, you know, feel like that youth need to be punished, and so part of that punishment is the shackling of the youth. But because in Oregon we're supposed to be rehabilitating youth, that's not supposed to be the reason for the shackling. So the only reason why youth should be shackled is if for some reason that youth has shown themselves and a judge makes a determination, you know, that they should be shackled.
And it shouldn't be punishment first, due process second.
Right, exactly. Okay, and that's what I have.
Thank you. Are there any questions? We're going to try to get hold of Dr. Beyer. She should be available now, okay. But are there any questions for the panel right now?
Actually, I did want to add one thing, if you don't mind. Is that okay? Sorry. I appreciate I forgot to add that because I'm an attorney and I talk with the youth, it makes a huge difference. I can tell you that when a kid is unrestrained, when they're in court, their quality of communication is so much better. The back and forth, you can see them come to life, and it really does make a big difference with respect to their ability to aid and assist and participate in their defense.
Thank you.
Thank you.
One week, same week.
Marty Beyer.
Hello, Dr. Beyer. This is Floyd Przanski, Chair on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Thank you for being available for us. You are live. I'm wondering if you can hear us okay.
I can hear you well. How about you? Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am, we can. Thank you very much. If you'd be so kind to just put your name on the record, and if you'll give us your presentation, we really would appreciate it.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be here this afternoon. My name is Marty Beyer. I am a clinical psychologist, and I specialize in adolescent development, including trauma. I utilize an adolescent development framework in training judges, lawyers, probation officers, and juvenile facility staff, and in my own work individually with juveniles who are in court. The goal of courts that hear juvenile cases is developmentally sound justice. That applies to not only the decisions reached by the court, but also to the way juveniles are treated in court. It's crucial to consider the effects of shackling juveniles in an adolescent development context. Adolescence is an important time for moral development. As anyone who has raised a teenager knows, because of where they are in moral development, adolescents are intolerant. Very tolerable sometimes, yes. Very tolerant of unfairness. To a teenager who knows they will not harm others and will not misbehave in the courtroom, it seems unfair to be shackled. They don't have the adult perspective to accept shackling just because it's universal. That it happens to everyone in court doesn't make it fair in the eyes of a juvenile. They cannot help reacting to the unfairness of shackling, which can distract them throughout a hearing and interfere with their learning important lessons from the judge and begin to take responsibility for their actions. Secondly, adolescence is an important time for identity development. Approval of others has a powerful influence on developing a strong, positive identity. Being shackled is humiliating for young people. They feel ashamed and disapproved of in a public place and in front of family. Adolescents can experience lasting emotional harm from feeling humiliated and ashamed. Moreover, for youth of color, being degraded by shackles may be experienced as racism, which is harmful to the development of a positive identity. Third, many court-involved teenagers have experienced severe trauma, including abuse and neglect. Shackles can re-traumatize youths who may be flooded with upsetting memories of physical and sexual abuse that they could not do anything about. This sense of powerlessness is harmful to a traumatized young person and can lead to their feeling betrayed again by adults. In this situation, adults who are condoning shackles. Feeling hurt and angry in court may add to the difficulties a young person has in trusting professionals who want to help them recover from traumatic pasts, whether that's through probation and other services in the community or caring professionals in detention and in juvenile facilities or other residential settings. That trust is crucial for their recovering from trauma. Because of these harms on moral development and on identity development, and for youth who have been traumatized, juvenile facilities across the country, detention centers, and rehabilitation programs are only permitted to use physical restraint in rare circumstances. In the unusual situation when a juvenile is restrained in a facility, he or she understands it was because their behavior was out of control. As soon as they calm down, they are released from the restraint. This sends a message that makes sense to the teenager about the connection between their out-of-control behavior and the restraint, which, as I said, rarely happens in juvenile facilities. Unlike the message sent by shackling of all youth in court, regardless of behavior. Finally, seeing and feeling supported by family and communicating with defense counsel during court hearings, which can be very anxiety provoking for a teenager, is essential. They still emotionally rely on adults much as they did as younger children. Being shackled can physically interfere with a teenager being able to communicate in the courtroom with their family and with their attorney. And important opportunities to get adult advice for changing their delinquent behavior may be lost. Those are my comments. Thank you so much for this opportunity to put shackling into an adolescent development context. And thank you for your interest in developmentally sound justice in Oregon.
Dr. Beyer, thank you very much. Let me just ask if there's anyone here that had any questions for Dr. Beyer. Dr. Beyer, thank you again very much for taking time out of your busy day to present this information to us. We really appreciate your time and efforts in this area.
Well, thank you for your flexibility in allowing me to do it on the phone.
Thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.
You too. Bye-bye. Bye.
So I think our last is Judge Welch and Roxanne Scott.
Good afternoon, Senator Przanski and Representative Barker and members of this group. My name is Elizabeth Welch. I'm a retired Multnomah County Circuit Court judge. I worked in the DA's office in Portland in the juvenile court starting in 1969. Worked there for about 5 years and then served as a circuit judge for about 17. And then I retired and I did Plan B for 5 years. And people who want to do juvenile work are kind of like some kind of rare asset. So I got to go all over the state, not literally, but many places, and see how juvenile courts function. And the main thing I got out of it, other than I couldn't close my eyes from being gaping during that time, is how unbelievably different courts are on issues like this. And like actually some even more profound issues, the inconsistency of the way in which these programs operate is mind-boggling. I'm currently on the Public Defense Services Commission, and so in that capacity have also been able to see what's going on elsewhere and how people look at these issues. And I guess the one thing I want to point out that's not in my notes is I think it's remarkable that Judge Collins and I, as the two judges appearing before you today, are both former prosecutors. And I think that might tell you a little bit about how fundamental this issue is. It's not a protagonist's issue. It's an issue about how we organize our system and how we treat human beings. What is the purpose of shackling in the courtroom? That's the question. And I think you're going to have a hard time finding anybody who has a very good answer to that. To keep order in the court? I think Judge Collins' discussion in his wonderful opinion letter sets forth how that can be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. If you need to keep order, if there's a problem, then you have to do something about it. If there isn't a problem, you don't have to do anything about it. To prevent the kids from absconding, And finally, to give the juvenile a message. Now, I took a random sample. I'm kidding now. I took a random sample of juvenile court administrators. I'm married to one who did this work for 35 years. He was the juvenile court director in Clackamas County. And so I said to him, what would you say about your experience with this subject? And he said, I and everybody who ever worked for me had kids who ran when they were in transit. But I never had, and no one who worked for me ever absconded from the courtroom, ever, 35 years. Ending, by the way, a long time ago, but still, it's all the same system. In transit is a different issue, and I don't see any reason why the in transit discussion should even come into this. It's the subject is you are in the courtroom, you are being held accountable. This is a ritual of fairness and openness, and why does this need to happen? And to me, the real issue here is there really still support in our society for a juvenile court? And if there is, why do we have a juvenile court? And we have a juvenile court for all the reasons that the other witnesses who've testified here have talked about, and I don't want to insult you by repeating it. We're talking about children, and the fact they're 15 years old doesn't keep from the fact they are children. And we want them not to get labeled any more than necessary. The concept of negative labeling has been a part of the philosophy and culture of the juvenile court for almost a century, for actually more than a century. We maintain the separate system because we still believe that children should be dealt with in a different way. And I disagree with the statute when it says how do you rehabilitate a child? What you're trying to do is develop a healthy human being, a functional, worthwhile adult. And you don't do that by telling them they're bad and that they're scary and they're a menace, and therefore you got to tie them up in the midst of this process. I tried to scan through my years on the bench, and I can remember very, very few in those, I'm going to say, 22 years, including Plan B, very few kids even being brought in shackles. I think it's a very much of an area by area and region by region issue. And there'll be a few kids along the way who will need to have some kind of restraints. The process, a simple process of getting court permission. I understand Judge Collins' view about doing it when the child enters the courtroom. I was surprised to hear there was no shackling policy in Multnomah County, because I was the chief judge there for many years, and it may not have been written down, but we had a policy, and it was dealt with before the hearing. If there was going to be shackling, the defense lawyer had an obligation to bring the matter before the court, and the court would decide whether it was necessary or not. But in any event, there needs to be a process, six of one, half a dozen of the other. Judges who are assigned to juvenile court are often uninitiated in its philosophy, in its history, and its culture, and that's a problem. And they assert, when asked about this business with shackling, they assert that they are deferring to law enforcement people. My primary message that I would like to convey to you today is that in the courtroom, the judge is in charge and needs to be in charge and to deal with this issue consistently with the law and with the traditions of American jurisprudence. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Roxanne Scott. I'm a defense attorney out in Clackamas County. I've been doing juvenile court work out there for about 18 years, with the focus on the juvenile law. The practice out in Clackamas County, the more I hear, is probably one of the more difficult and more often shackled. In fact, the policy in Clackamas County is that every youth is shackled. Their hands are cuffs, they have belly chains, even if they're so small that the chain has to wrap around their body three times. They are shackled on their wrists and body, body wrap chain, their ankles, and then they have a chain. In Clackamas County, you have to go downstairs in order to get to the table, if the child is in fact allowed to go to the table. They also have a booth that looks a lot like a hockey penalty booth, all glassed in. It's above and in the back of the courtroom, and that's where the youth are. Up until recently, they were shackled even within there. The youth are shackled from the time that they leave the Donald E. Long, which is in Multnomah County, and transported down to Clackamas County, which takes a minimum of 30 minutes. They are then continued to be shackled and held in a room from 12:30 until approximately 1 o'clock when the hearings start. They remain shackled until they go into the penalty box, or if we ask for them to go to the table, on occasion they are allowed to go, but only if they remain in shackles. If we have a hearing down at the Main Street Courthouse, the youth are shackled and brought all the way through the public hallways where everybody is at, in shackles, and then taken back through all of the hallways in shackles. Again, there are stairs there as well. The youth then, after they leave the courtroom, are shackled, and they remain in shackles until all of the youth have completed their hearings, and they are transported back to Donald E. Long. As I was preparing for today, I did the math, and it looks like they're averaging being in shackles from 90 minutes to 2-plus hours on average for every time they come to court. And as mentioned before, that means every 10 days that they're in detention. That's without regard to the offense that they've been alleged to have committed. It's without regard to their age, so whether they're 12 years old or 13 years old, it's without regard to mental health or cognitive abilities. So recently, in the last 2 weeks, I have a 13-year-old who has significant cognitive and mental health issues. He's been in the dependency arena for the last 5 or 6 years, so since he was 6 or 7. He was so nervous and so distraught about the shackles that he was uncontrollably shaking from the time that he left the courtroom and was put back in shackles again. I also recently had a case that was very disturbing. I have a 16-year-old who's been in the dependency world again since she was around 8 or 9. So she's been in a long time. She's 16 now. She was born in Liberia. She happens to be black. She was born during the war in Liberia. And so she was at 5 years old put in charge of an infant and told to keep the child quiet because the soldiers are coming through. When she did that, the baby didn't survive because she put her hand over the child's nose and mouth. This, of course, created quite a problem in Liberia. And so she was adopted out to a family in Oregon. In Oregon, she was adopted to a white family who disciplined her by tying her to a chain in the front yard like you would a dog, or putting her into a cage much like a dog kennel. She was burned by cigarettes, and she was sexually abused by the older child of this adoptive family. The adoptive family actually turned her over to DHS because they didn't know what to do with her and she was so out of control, where she then bounced around from foster home and program to program. Not surprisingly, with all that trauma involved in her life, she has some behaviors. And it's very difficult to manage those behaviors. And specifically, she was put into a program where they are allowed to put holds on children. Last summer, she became suicidal, not because holds were being put on her, but because on a weekly basis, there were holds put on other youth in that program. She was hospitalized for about a week, and the physicians at the hospital indicated that she needed to not be around when people were put in holds like that because it re-triggered her trauma, made her suicidal. So as we come forward now and she has some delinquency charges, she continued to struggle with behaviors. She came to a dependency hearing at our Main Street Courthouse. where we talked about the problem that she was struggling in the program, that what she needed to do in order to turn things around. But because she had delinquency charges pending, her court counselor felt as though it was necessary to take her in on a probation or conditions of release violation. And so as soon as that hearing was done, while she was in the courtroom, she was shackled, not just cuffed. The adults in the Main Street Courthouse, when they get taken from out of custody and put in custody, they are just cuffed, handcuffs only. She was not just cuffed. She was put in full shackles again. The wrists, the belly wraps, the chains on the legs, the whole nine yards, and shuffled through the Main Street Courthouse throughout all of the adults that are there. She felt like an animal. She felt like a slave. She told me she felt like a slave. Her self-worth is so low after all the things that were done to her, and then for this to happen on top. We've been fortunate to let her out into a shelter program to see if there is some place for her, because there's no family either. So she's trying, but we have a lot to rehabilitate, and after having her shackled, it makes it even harder, because we have to undo all the re-triggered damage and trauma that she's been through. She had another hearing the other day, a review hearing, and she was so afraid of being shackled again that after the hearing she had to go in the bathroom and throw up. She is that impacted by being shackled and how the system is going for her at this point in time. So I would ask that you really consider this and take a look at what the shackling is doing to our youth and how it impacts their ability to be able to then follow the rules that we're asking them to follow and to really respect what we are asking, because for them it doesn't feel as though we respect them under those conditions and circumstances. That's all.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Gelser.
How old is this young woman now?
She's now 16.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much for coming forward and giving your testimony and the examples.
Thank you.
Colleagues, I believe that concludes our presentations for today. Chair Barker, do you have any comments?
Do you have anything
else? Well, with that, the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary will go ahead and close for today. And thank you very much for being here. Safe travels.
Ready's closed. Thank you.
But not all of it. I've heard.
Ready's closed. Thank you.
I've heard this.